conflict admits the difficulty of defeating the Taliban as more U.S. soldiers die in Afghanistan.
Iran's foreign minister meets Afghan leaders ahead of an international conference in Kabul. And an Indian-administered Kashmir government forces open live fire on protesters, killing one and injuring several others.
Hello everyone, it's 2:30 a.m. here in Tehran and you're watching the news here on Press TV.
Our top story this hour, NATO's Secretary General says the US and its allies underestimated the difficulty of the Afghan mission when they went to war in the country. Agnes Foss Rasmussen says the underestimation is the reason why it is taking a long time to establish peace and stability in Afghanistan. Rasmussen's remarks come on the eve of a key international conference on Afghanistan in Kabul. He also warned of the rising casualties of the US-led forces in the war. The NATO chief says Taliban will make their utmost not to lose their strongholds in the face of US-led crackdowns. Rasmussen predicted that the Taliban counterattacks will inflict heavier casualties on the foreign troops.
Well, bomb attacks have killed two U.S. soldiers and six Afghan policemen in southern Afghanistan. The U.S. soldiers were killed in separate bomb attacks. The exact locations of the attacks are not yet known. The deaths bring the number of foreign soldiers killed in Afghanistan this year to 380. The six Afghan policemen were killed when their vehicle was hit by a roadside bomb in the rest of Kandahar province. Four other policemen were wounded in the attack. Meanwhile, at least four loud blasts have been heard in the Afghan capital, Kabul. NATO and Afghan forces have not commented on the cause of the blast so far. Well, Press TV's Faiz Khorshid told us more about the attacks.
The American soldiers stationed here in Afghanistan, especially in southern Afghanistan, continue to die in an unpopular war. These two U.S. soldiers were killed in two separate roadside bombings. The roadside bombings are believed to be an unavoidable tactic, and the Taliban militants are heavily relying on this tactic. And this tactic has been quite successful for the Taliban militants to inflict heavy casualties on native forces across Afghanistan. The Taliban militants claim responsibility for these attacks, saying that this is a message for the Afghan government as well as for native forces stationed in Afghanistan that they are winning this war.
Well, Iran's Foreign Minister Manuchehr Mortaki is in Afghanistan to take part in the key international conference on the future of the war-torn nation.
Upon his arrival in Kabul, Mortaki said Tehran regards a stable Afghanistan as vital to regional security. Let's hear from him.
The Iranian delegation will hold talks alongside other nations with Afghan officials during its visit to Kabul. The talks will cover different ways to reach a perfect solution to the Afghan plight. We hope that the conference will issue a communique that will serve the best interests of the Afghan people and will help establish peace and security in the country. Iran believes that stability in Afghanistan equals security in the region. Therefore, Iran has always focused on this objective.
The Iranian foreign minister also met with Afghan President Hamid Karzai shortly after his arrival. Karzai and UN Chief Ban Ki-moon are to chair Tuesday's meeting. Regional security as well as an economic development and cooperation topped the agenda of the gathering. Representatives from 70 countries, including about 40 foreign ministers, will attend the event.
Turkey is to try 196 people over a coup plot against the country's government. A Turkish court has charged the suspects with involvement in a conspiracy in 2003 to create chaos and pave the way for a military coup. No date has been set yet for the trial. The suspects include some 30 serving or retired military officers. Most of them were detained in February. The suspects were subsequently released after a national newspaper published allegedly leaked copies of documents detailing their plans.
A bomb attack on a convoy of a British security firm in northern Iraq has killed four foreigners. One of the dead is confirmed to be British, but the nationalities of the others are yet to be known. Police say five Iraqi civilians were also wounded in the incident in Mosul. Iraqi security forces have sealed off the scene and blocked all roads leading to the area. Mosul has been the scene of major security crackdowns by US troops and Iraqi security forces to uproot the militancy that erupted shortly after the US-led invasion in 2003.
Well, Iraqi politicians have once again failed to reach an agreement on the formation of a new government. Yet another meeting gathering political party heads in Baghdad came to an end without results.
The leaders of different Iraqi political parties and blocs held a meeting in the parliament building in an attempt to break the deadlock and reach an agreement on forming the new government. Choosing the new prime minister as well as the three presidential positions and other high-profile posts have been real hurdles for Iraqi politicians more than 4 months after the parliamentary elections. The two leading politicians who emerged from the March 7th parliamentary elections are Ayad Alawi, who heads the Iraqiya Alliance, and Nouri al-Maliki, head of State of Law Coalition. But neither of them won enough seats to form a new government on its own. The Iraqiya bloc, whose head met Syrian president in Damascus on Monday, blamed the current administration for the lack of security and called on officials to put the nation's interest before those of their parties and form a new government without any further delay.
The Iraqiya bloc is sure that the security deterioration is because of political disputes, and we urge the political parties and officials to put their interests aside and serve their country.
The two lists which won most seats are still bickering over who should be the next prime minister, but they have reportedly agreed on a rolling structure where Maliki and Alawi's team share half of the posts and the remaining seats go to their sides proportionate to their election results. Amid rumors that the political uncertainty may hinder the planned withdrawal of all U.S. troops from the country by the end of August, Iraqi lawmakers stressed that any delay in the formation of the government will not affect that process.
The U.S. troops are leaving Iraq and nothing will delay their withdrawal from the country.
A political bloc needs 163 seats in the 325-member parliament in order to form a government. The Iraqi lawmakers stressed that the withdrawal of the U.S. troops will never be affected by delaying the formation of the Iraqi government and showed opposition to any extension for the presence of the U.S. troops in Iraq. Hussam Al-Bati, Press TV, from the Iraqi capital, Baghdad.
American-born cleric Anwar al-Awlaki says U.S. President Barack Obama is planning to send troops to Yemen. Al-Awlaki has warned Americans that their country's forces will get stuck in Yemen just as they are stuck in Afghanistan and Iraq. Al-Qaeda-linked cleric made the comments in an audio message that surfaced on Monday. Washington accuses al-Awlaki of inciting hatred against the United States, and it has instructed the CIA to assassinate him. Al-Awlaki is widely believed to be in Yemen. Reports say the U.S. has opened a largely covert front against what Washington calls al-Qaeda in Yemen.
Well, now, in Kashmir, Indian forces have opened fire on protesters in the capital, Srinagar, killing a man. Police say 13 more protesters were injured in the gunfire. The fresh protests began after rescue workers found the body of another protester, allegedly drowned by security forces on Saturday. Police say they opened fire after they failed to disperse protesters by other means. The latest death brings the number of people killed since anti-Indian demonstrations began in early June to 17. The crisis erupted after police killed a teenage boy at a protest against New Delhi's rule. Well, Press TV's Shahina Bhatt from Srinagar told us more about the situation in Kashmir.
Things are like turning really, really worse in Kashmir, as already it has been more than a month now that the life in the region has been hit hard because of the killings of civilians. It's already evident that Amnesty has asked India to probe the earlier deaths that occurred in June. And so far, none of the probes has really occurred. And the situation is like each and after a few days, you see new killings. Although there have been some orders of not firing on protesters, but to add to your surprise, I don't think that there are any ears to listen to what the local officials are telling and ordering those who are in charge to the security.
A new study has found that low-income urban areas in the U.S. suffer from HIV and AIDS epidemics. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention say many poor inner-city districts across the U.S. are badly hit by the deadly virus. While most other studies identify homosexuals, African Americans or Hispanics as those most at risk, this report says poverty is the single most important factor among the population at large. More than 1 million people in the U.S. are already infected with HIV. Another 56,000 are infected every year. Let's discuss this report further with Larry Burns, the director of the Council on Hemispheric Affairs, that joins us now via satellite from Washington. Thanks for being with us, Mr. Burns. So this striking similarity here between those who are suffering from HIV and poverty in the United States, it's not something that you would think about straight away when relating these two. What do you make of this report, and what is it telling us about the situation with HIV and AIDS in the United States?
Well, I think it's an immensely important report. Of course, there's an international AIDS meeting now taking place in Vienna, Austria. It's a huge meeting, a very important meeting. And it was decided to release this document on this research at that meeting, and it was an absolute bombshell because for the very reason of what you just suggested, that rather than racial, rather than medical, rather than intravenous shots or whatever, the unique feature in this group, this very large group of heterosexual males, 9,000 in size over a number of years, that poverty, that is where they ranked on the income scale, was an accurate predictor repeatedly in their economic and medical status. Now, this has a very important social implications for the United States, because what it means is that you have 1 million addicted people in the country. And if you want to make inroads into those levels of addiction, you're going to have to improve their economic situation, which is much more difficult to do than to apply some form of medical relief. This report is going to set the stage for very wide discussions in Washington and elsewhere in this country, whether we can afford all these wars, afford all of these sort of applications of U.S. strength, or rather more attention should be paid to the economic shortcomings of the country that are having a profound effect on the population.
Because, of course, as I mentioned just before I spoke to you, a lot of people would think, well, in the United States, African Americans, Hispanics might be those who suffer from HIV more. But you're talking on the social aspect of this. Of course, those are communities who would live in poorer areas statistically, who might not be living to average in the United States. So social issues and economic issues very much intertwined here. And of course, the healthcare reforms have been a big issue as well. Do you think there's any link with that situation as well, with how healthcare is currently conducted in the United States?
Well, of course, we have a new healthcare legislation, and hopefully it will improve the situation in this country. Disgracefully enough, this country, with all of its advantages and advances, had one of the most primitive health programs in the world. And certainly every European country had a more sophisticated health plan than did the United States. But in terms of your acknowledgement that blacks tend to live in poverty-stricken areas, that the CDC report may not be all that sensational. Well, I think that you're both right. I think it is a sensational report, And I think you also have to qualify its findings with the fact that the typical black population of poverty-stricken areas of the inner cities is much higher than the white population, and that the per capita income of whites of the same category of being heterosexuals is significantly more than blacks, and of course would be a predictor of what's happening there.
And just finally, President Barack Obama has asked states and federal agencies to find ways to cut new HIV infections by 25% in efforts to stem this epidemic, to get more patients treated quickly and educate Americans about HIV. But the plan doesn't include any new funding above the $19 billion the U.S. already spends a year on domestic HIV prevention care or research, for example. Do you expect a deadline in the epidemics when there is no additional budget? Should more funding be spent on issues like this? I mean, healthcare is a big issue, the economic crisis is a big issue, but issues like HIV and AIDS, they almost get swept under the radar, swept under the carpet, unless there is, for example, a conference as we're seeing now.
Well, the danger here is that there is a very profound movement in the United States, particularly led by the Republican Party, to cut back federal spending. We're going through a period where the average American is complaining about high taxes and that Obama doesn't have the mandate to come forth with expensive new programs, however wise they may be. In fact, the U.S. on the supply side of drugs, which has been such a major contributor to HIV, there has been very little new money that's been put in. And in terms of the fight against AIDS, I can't imagine this being a high budgetary item for an administration that's being hit hard by conservative Republicans that they already are spending too much.
Okay, many thanks for your comments there. Larry Burns, Director of the Council on Hemispheric Affairs in Washington.
Now, the Washington Post has slammed what it calls U.S. intelligence failure to keep America safe. A media report says the expansion of intelligence services following the 9/11 attacks has led to a system lacking in oversight. Nearly 2,000 private companies and more than 1,200 government agencies are reportedly involved in counterterrorism activities across the U.S. Acting Intelligence Chief David Gombert has dismissed the Washington Post's criticism. He insists that the changes have led to significant improvements. The Washington Post cites recent failed bombings, among other incidents, as evidence of the weakness of U.S. intelligence. The White House recently admitted problems with intelligence gathering. It said the government is trying to fix the flaws.
Bangkok is calm after this spring's deadly street clashes between the opposition and security forces. But that doesn't mean that Thailand has passed the state of political uncertainty. Our correspondent in the Thai capital has more.
Bangkok is at peace now, but for how long, nobody knows, as there is simmering tension between the government and the opposition camp due to the campaigns they have launched to discredit each other. Early on Monday, the DSI, or the Department of Special Investigations, held a press conference in order to display the weapons seized from an alleged red shirt figure. Although red shirts have denied any link to the accused, the government is determined to show that there were armed elements within the red shirt camp who were responsible for various terror attacks in the city.
The public relations battle between the government and the pro-Richard opposition is certainly not over. Politicians have been using an upcoming Bangkok by-election as a platform on which to attack each other over various issues.
On the same day, the pro-Richard opposition party held an exhibition on its premises to honor those 90 people who lost their lives during the unrest in Bangkok in April and May. During the exhibition, friends and relatives of the deceased turned up in large numbers in remembrance of their loved ones.
There is no justice at all, because it has been many months and nothing happened, nor justice process from the government.
Many questions remain as to who was responsible for the killings. As long as those questions remain unanswered, the emotional wounds left after the unrest would remain raw. Issues like these serve as political fodder, especially in the upcoming by-election in Bangkok. Although the election only takes place in one constituency, its significance could not be overstated, as both the government and pro-red opposition are taking the opportunity to express their version of events. In a symbolic move, the pro-red shirt opposition has fielded one of its detained leaders as its candidate in the upcoming Bangkok by-election.
The election represents Bangkok in its time, and soon after the crackdown is an indicator of the importance of public opinion. Our hands are tied. If the Democrats do not win, it is still a moral victory. If we win, it means people have no confidence in the Democratic Party.
Although nobody knows what will happen next, it is clear that divisions in the Thai kingdom are still far from being bridged. Chen Fai Tam, Press TV, Bangkok.
Do log on to our website, presstv.ir, for all your latest news and analysis, updated 24 hours a day. The oil spill in China's biggest port, our top story on there.
Stay tuned. The 2010 Tour de France has 20 stages. We're through with stage 15. Find out more with Amir Hussein up next in Sports International.